Hello again, everyone. It's Kaz Beal, and this is Casual Conversations, where we speak to people who are very important to our world. And today's very special episode is about people who are important in our children's world. And our guest is Terry Blackwell. He is an LBCBA. Got lots of letters there on that screen, Terry. Tell me, what's all that about?
I have an Irish friend who says, the man has more degrees than the thermometer. the LBCBA, it's a licensure for the behavior analyst in New York State. I live in New Jersey, but New Jersey has yet to implement the licensure law. And then the SAS is a school principal, permanently licensed as a school administrator in the state of New York as well.
So tell me, let's go back to the beginning. How did you first get involved, in education, but how did you get involved with the BCBA programs?
Well, it was a kind of a challenging story. Our oldest son started to encounter some difficulty in the local Blue Ribbon public school. And my wife and I were called into a meeting. At the time, I was actually running special education programs under contract with the city of New York for preschoolers. And we went into this meeting, and the meeting progressed to be one wherein the social worker from the school, who was the case manager, the school principal, and a teacher, explained to us all the things that our son would never be able to do. And my wife and I were devastated. I had sat as a school principal at many IEP meetings, but never did I have my throat close up like it did the day that I was a dad the subject pointing out the limitations of my son's future that were going to be imposed by the opinions of a couple of, well-intentioned, I'll give them credit for that, administrators and social workers. So my wife and I left that meeting and we looked at each other and said, if our son is going to be helped, it's going to have to be dependent upon us. And we both went back and, took a very rigorous course of study with Dr. Vincent Carbone, who's at this point very internationally renowned for the verbal behavior method of working with children with autism. And, I ended up sitting for the test because I had the appropriate graduate degrees. And as my wife said, you use this professionally, I'll use this for our family. I think what was very, very important, and I would love to convey this to any family member that's listening, we had a very strong core belief that there is no such thing as failure in family. And we've lived with that to this day. That same son, who we were told would never achieve anything, graduated from Rutgers University with a master's and high honors in human resources. And today is raising a family. He's married for a long time.
Okay. All right. So as it says on the screen, Terry, changing the world one child at a time. And that's very important things to do, especially these days. I know we're talking about special needs and we'll get into that further, but what about, the general kids who are in school who are misbehaving in class for some reason? What are some of the reasons for that might be happening these days?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kaz. I don't know that people are generally aware that during the pandemic, when the teachers' unions generally shut down schools across the country, more than 2 million children were taken out of public education and are now being homeschooled or have gone over to private or parochial schools. And I think that if you were to look at the research about why teachers are leaving the field, new teachers, I believe it's more than 50% of new teachers coming into the field leave because they have problem behavior with children in their classes and are unable to administer or uneducated to administer appropriate procedures to reduce those problem behaviors. So back to the question of why, one of the key things that when I was out there training, I learned to ask a very different question through behavior analysis very early, and that was, what function does the behavior serve? And the nice thing about behavior analysis is there is more at this point than 80 years of research. And the answer is functional, right? That the behavior is always functional to the learner. It may not make a great deal of sense to you or I, but if there are people in the room, there's really only two functions of behavior as to why children are behaving. The first function is attention or access to tangible reinforcement, such as stuff. Right? I want what I want when I want it. And this behavior in the past has allowed me to get it. Or more often is escape from demand. So I tell the child to do something or I put a demand in place and they basically exhibit problem behavior to escape that demand. And in the research, about 2/3 of problem behavior comes from escape from demand or a delay in demand. A great example at home might be when you say to the child, I want you to clean your room. And the child throws a tantrum, throws themselves on the floor, and the parent just gives up and walks away. Well, that child has basically been taught this behavior is effective for either delaying or removing the demand, and that's problematic.
So how would you, in a classroom setting, You know, I know some teachers who are just starting out, or they're teaching educational or religious classes, XECD or something, and they have continual behavior issues with kids. You know, in that short time period, they have to do a lot of information. So, what are some of the things they can do to kind of help the child and gain some control to be not disruptive in class? Because, you know, they can't just like take them out of class; they have to be there. So what can they do?
Well, keep in mind that behavior analysis, while it is a science, is not magic. So a child who has developed a behavioral pattern over years is not going to immediately respond to interventions, but progressively. So I think if I was to offer, and I have in the in-service trainings I've done in different places, say to teachers, look, if you were to pick one technique that would be most helpful for reducing problem behavior, it is catching kids doing things right and letting them know about it very, very quickly, meaning within seconds. Focusing on the positive and reinforcing more heavily that which you want, as opposed to particularly, you know, the kid who's the wisecracker, who's making jokes and cracking up the class. You know, there's a term in behavior analysis called extinction, which means you don't give it the same attention that it got in the past. The challenge with that is that very often that same kid is thinking, well, it worked for me in the past. Maybe I got to crank it up a little bit. So the better alternative is for the teacher to really very heavily focus on targeted behaviors that they want to reinforce to use behavior analysis, meaning they want more of that in the future and less of the other. Catch kids doing things right and reinforce it very, very quickly.
Hey Terry, that was a great answer. Am I reinforcing you quickly? Was
Yeah.
that
For a quick learning class, that was well done.
enough? Right there to the point. I'm listening. I'm not just like reading off questions like some other show. You know, it's very casual conversation here. So, what is that? You planning to have like a bird fly above your head there or something? You got all that space there all of a sudden. What's going
It's just tilting. Things tilt up, things tilt down.
on? That's true. That's a good television term, tilt. Tilt pan, you know, take a course on that, find out what all that is about. So let's progress to special needs situations. So there's IEP and 504 plan. So why don't you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I think that these things have become progressively more and more common and more important. I have been in the field of developmental disabilities long before I was a father. I started in 1980, so I'm an old guy. That's 43 years.
No, you're not. Come on.
Yeah. Two things that I've seen, both of which concern me. When I was in graduate school, I remember studying and in fact had a conversation with Congressman Chris Smith. He remembered the same book, that only one out of every 10,000 children were diagnosed with autism. And you know, now if you were to look at the statistics today, it's there are two problems with that. One, that one in 10,000 has now become, I believe, in the state of New Jersey at least, one out of every 27 infant males being born tonight, baby boys, one out of every 27 will be diagnosed with autism. Now, there's a different ratio on the percentage of females, and they're not really sure, but they think there's a genetic link there as to the why of that. And on the other side, for almost my entire life, the percentage of the population who was considered developmentally delayed was pretty static at about 3%. Now, people would argue different definitions and different percentages, but what I've noticed is the one that I'm looking at has all of a sudden in the past few years jumped up to 4%. Part of that because of the incidence of autism. Part of it, I believe, is that there is really a maybe a better diagnostic going on with infants and more attention. But this leads to an issue now where we used to very seldom hear about an IEP because when it's one in 10,000, how many kids are having an IEP? Today, an individualized education plan, which is what the IEP stands for, is a plan to support the needs of the child in a public school setting. And the federal law for that is the FAPE, Free and Appropriate Public Education. For children who don't need the more intensive supports of an IEP, there's something called a 504 plan, which is a Rehabilitation Act accommodation. Those two tools are available to parents predominantly who advocate for their children to get appropriate supports so that their kids can make progress in school.
No, that's great. I mean, basically, I just want to let people know that we're Terry Blackwell here, and this is also an audio podcast. So if you're watching this on internet or on cable, and we see how great, handsome Terry and I look, you can check the video. But if you want listening on the audio version, go check out the video, and you'll learn a lot from information. Plus, you'll find a way to dress because we're both nicely dressed also today.
There you go.
So that's really cool.
That's a tie.
Yeah, I know. We're trying to be a little more relaxed today, you know, jacket and no tie. So tell me about more about the programs that basically, you know, schools use to help children out.
Sure. Well, there's conjecture. I come at things from the behavior analytic side, which basically is measurable progress. I think that the IEP, let me spend a second for parents who might right now be considering or going through a renewal of their IEP. It's an annual plan, which essentially represents a contract between the district and the family or the guardian as to these are the things that we're going to do to successfully help your child have, quote, meaningful progress. And that's a key term. The challenge there, of course, is to have meaningful progress. It has to be measurable. And in several court decisions, including a Supreme Court decision of a couple of years ago, to be meaningful, it must be measurable. And the Supreme Court in a Denver case with a child with autism used the term, it can't be de minimis. In my terminology, you can't just warehouse a kid and push them along from year to year to year, because that's not consistent with the intent of the FAPE or the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The 504 plan is for a child who might need some accommodations. Perhaps they have, and I'm just picking one or two here, perhaps they have a hearing accommodation or they have an orthopedic issue. And so they need some special adaptive equipment in the classroom for hearing, or perhaps they need some accommodations and modifications in their gross motor movement in phys ed. Those plans, the 504s, in my experience, take a good deal of time and effort to develop, but very often in my experience, the public schools don't really pay close attention to them, which is unfortunate because I think they're there for a reason under the Rehabilitation Act. Whereas the IEP requires regular meetings, statements of progress, annual planning. Every 3 years, there should be a comprehensive evaluation and status check, at least of the child's progress in the area of their disability. And so those are the two tools. In my experience, the IEP in a good school district is treated very seriously. The case manager is usually the center of the coordination of efforts between all of the variety of disciplines. There might be a speech pathologist, a special educator, perhaps an occupational therapist for fine motor coordination. All of those will be coordinated by a case manager. In New Jersey and New York, the special ed teacher is responsible for that. But I believe that the IEP for a child with special needs is really, that's the advantage of a public school setting versus the homeschool setting or the parochial setting that doesn't have that resource available or that rich array of resources.
Terry, what if someone wants to become a registered behavioral technician? What are the resources out there? Because, you know, I think it's a great position because it makes you feel better, you improve in the world. Mm-hmm. Children's lives, people's lives, and also, you know, a good job, and it benefits everyone. So how can you, what are the process of becoming a registered behavioral technician?
So it's actually relatively simple. For example, the BCBA, Board Certified Behavior Analyst, requires a master's degree in the discipline. It requires a year of supervised practice. It requires a test. I was fortunate to get through it and actually quite surprised to get through it on the first go round. Whereas the registered behavior tech is a high school degree, a criminal background check, a 40-hour online course, which basically provides an education in, and I'm going to paraphrase, I would say it's the education in the basics of behavior analysis, as well as an introduction as to how to apply those methods to obtain measurable results. The RBT is not the professional leading the team, but the RBT very often will be the person who is tasked with data collection, appropriately shaping behavior, and implementing those plans that are developed by a BCBA.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they're supervised by somebody else, so it's not something you take a course and then you're there by yourself. So because it requires a lot of care and supervision of the individuals involved. What about, you know, one of the issues we run into is, you know, once the school is over, you know, there's that summertime break. Like, what mm-hmm. can parents of kids who have special needs, what are the resources out there for them that they can use that you've seen? Because, you know, they learned a lot during the school, but I'm sure some things get lost because they won't have the same, you know, track, the same schedule. So what are some resources for that that you see?
Yeah, I stick with behavior analysis. And I think even with parents, catching kids doing things right, there was a subset or a method of applied behavior analysis called positive behavioral supports, which focuses very much on just that. Let's catch kids doing things right. Let's get more of that and less of the non-desired behavior. You raise an interesting point about the summer break. If you keep in mind that schools, by their nature, at most operate 210 days a year. So that's a 180-day, 9-month school year, September to June usually. And then during the summer, I know it's different from state to state, but I'm going to use New York. There's a 30-day, what they call extended school year. The challenge with the extended school year is that the requirement for a child to receive that additional service is usually that they have something called substantial regression, meaning that if they were to lack being in school for the period July and August, they would actually regress more time than they had off. So concretely, you know, I get out of school in June, but in that, I think, 8 to 10 week period, I'm going to regress, you know, at least 8 weeks. The real challenge now that that's being implemented in different states is there's no tool in my knowledge that measures at that fine week by week level. Typically, the measurement of delay that you would use for substantial regression is going to be a tool that was based upon looking at year by year or at best month by month. So for parents who are working with children who have special needs, and you know, the term I would use is they want to shape adaptive behavior. Probably the most important adaptive behavior to shape is communication. Years ago, I remember running into a gentleman by the name of Ami Klin, who was the co-director at the Yale Child Study Institute. And he was given a presentation, and there was an aspect that I really liked. You know, he talked about the Dr. Seuss characters, things one and things two. And he said social communication over and over, that those were the targets that at the clinic they were really focused very much on. Very often children who have limited communication have this internal event we call frustration, and they may act in different ways, either to access stuff, you know, I want what I want when I want it, or having the inability to say, hey, Kaz, you know, you already asked me 10 questions. I'm getting tired. Give me a break. Not having that, I might exhibit some new and novel behavior that lets you know that we're done here.
Right. So, what tips can you give, four or five to parents, parents who are new to dealing with children with special needs kids that may not know from your experience, that would be useful either, you know, in their home life or also when they're dealing with the schools.
Yeah, and here I have some personal biases that come into effect that are not within the realm of ABA. I think the first one is that you have to be very careful about physicians and labels, right? If I go into with my kid because they're throwing tantrums and I get a label, oppositional defiant behavior, that doesn't really help me, right? It's a label. And then typically what will come along with that is some sort of a medication, sometimes prescribed off-label. Again, this is outside of the realm of BCBA. This is more the parent experience. I think you have to be very, very careful with that. If it is your intent to help your child grow in the least restrictive environment, meaning with, in my opinion, the best chance for success in their regular community, you want to look for solutions as opposed to labels. So if I have a child who has something that becomes labeled oppositional defiant behavior, okay, thank you for the label. Now, what do I do about that other than just give them a tranquilizer or give them a pill? Again, that's an opinion. On the side of behavioral shaping, I think for parents who are new, first of all, the day that you receive a diagnosis is very, very heavy, very difficult to grapple with. You know, I think many parents over time that I've worked with, you know, say to me, well, what am I going to do, you know, when I'm older and my child is older? I think the answer lies in the planning and the question that you asked. There's a brilliant man over here, Dr. Thomas Mazzarelli, that worked with the Middlesex County VOTEC and was a professor up at Seton Hall University. You know, and he used to ask what I thought was a great question. He said, project yourself 10 years into the future. Who are your children associating with? What are they doing for an occupation? What are they doing? Where are they living? who are they associating with, what's their recreation? And it was very, very difficult to encounter that series of questions and to think about it both as professional and parent, because it requires you to get out of the here and now. And very often you're tired. You know, this it's a lot of work raising kids. So I think planning, back to your original question, planning where are we today and where are we going to be 5, 10, 15 years down the road becomes an important question. I would suggest that in answer number three tip, take a look at both the adaptive positive behaviors that you want to see more of. And if you have problem behavior, don't let it create the entire context of your planning. If you have a five-year-old who's throwing themselves on the floor at the supermarket going out because you're not picking up the Hershey bar at the checkout, which by the way, do you think it's accidental they have all the candy at the checkout?
You know, have you picked up any lately, Terry, candy?
Yeah, unfortunately, too much.
Well, you travel a lot, so I'm sure a little energy boost every now and then, you know, to keep you going.
But there you go. But, you know, as a parent, I think it's very often the problem behavior that dominates your thinking. Think about it as a replacement. There's a concept in applied behavior analysis called the fair pair. If I am a child that cannot verbally communicate, are there other methods that I might use? Sign language, for example. I didn't know this when I got into the field, that there is a individual in each police department across the United States who knows sign language. Wow. That to a parent should be pretty comforting, because if your kid gets lost in some big theme park, know that there will be somebody, if they're nonverbal, that they could sign, and there will be somebody that can communicate with them and help them get home. Again, the communication and socialization, key critical components. And the last tip that I would make for those parents who have an IEP, there's an attorney that I worked with in New Jersey, who was also a parent of a significantly challenged little girl. And he raised the issue that I had really never thought of and hadn't read about. He said, look, within the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is the federal act for special ed, there's a component that says that what you educate the child in school has to generalize to their home environment. And as soon as I heard it, I thought, well, boy, that makes a great deal of common sense. If I teach a child how to ask for something, but it only is functional within the classroom and not back when they're at the mall or when they're at home, then what really have I done? So generalization is also a tremendously important aspect of training within an IEP.
No, it's wonderful information, Terry. Changing the world one child at a time. It's a great subject, and it's nice to see also that special needs kids. I see them more often working in supermarkets, real world jobs, and doing things like that. Where I remember a long time ago, that wasn't much of a world there. They're out in the public, they see them places, and it's all very acceptable, and I think helps them with their self confidence and experience, and they'll go on from that. So if you had to summarize everything that we talked about today in a little time capsule, two or three little things, how would you describe, so what are key takeaways for people to get away from this conversation we had today, to take away?
I think about your last comment, and it raises an issue that we didn't touch on, which is transitioning. It's a fancy term for what happens to my kid when they turn 18 and they don't have the supports of special education any longer. And I'm going to pick on New Jersey because unfortunately we rank very, very low in the program services for people who are adults with developmental disabilities. And that's based upon a guy by the name of Lou Brown, who does a study on this. If you have a child who's approaching graduation, what happens next, right? I hear a lot of people use the term, my child is about to fall off a cliff. And what they're actually referencing is that while they were in a school district, they were receiving a multiplicity of supports, speech therapy, all the different therapies that I rolled through, and perhaps some extracurricular things to help the child learn to socialize. 18 happens, they graduate, and what happens? There's no funding, or very, very minimal funding, or an extremely long wait to get any funding. I believe that it's very important for parents of children who are at least 10 to get in touch with the adult services providers in their state, typically that are funded predominantly by Medicaid, but to at least have the conversation of care coordination and case management at an early age so that that cliff can be softened. I've seen some waiting lists in states that just stagger my imagination at 10 years plus. And there's actually an article I read a few years ago about how many millions, literally millions of parents are in their 70s and 80s with adult children, panicked at what's going to happen when they pass away and their child is left at home. So early planning, coordination, and being proactive is really a key essential, I think, throughout that's laced throughout this entire conversation.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. It's been an exciting, informative, and a wonderful interview with you. Thank you for taking the time to being on Casual Conversation. The toughest question of all today, what was it like being on Casual Conversations?
It was very casual.
Very casual. Did you learn anything by yourself?
Well, I think what you did is you kind of prompted me to tie some things together. I guess my as I'm getting older, one of the things that I've learned, and actually I give credit to Vince Carbone for this, is context is very important. And when you're in the moment, it's kind of hard to back off and get the context of a full life lived. So when you're the parent of a child who's just received a diagnosis of autism at the age of 4 or maybe 3, and that child is nonverbal, that's your entire world. It's essential to get some peace and some space and to back off and put that life in context relative to the full life lived that Tom Mazzarelli talked about.
Wow. We'll put all the links below to the information, to the website, to the 40-hour RBT course, also, which you can take. And it's a wonderful resource for everyone. So check it out. Terry Blackwell, thanks a lot for being a great guest on Casual Conversations.